I try, yes, he said. My English isn't fluent, but it's close, and this story is so delicate. I'm sure there were things I missed the first time around. I wanted to try again. Yes, she smiled at him, feeling slightly crazy. She ignored this feeling and plowed recklessly ahead. When you're finished, you could come back. We could discuss it. Oh, he nodded eagerly. You have a book club here? Her mouth opened slightly. No, she laughed. Just me. All the better. He smiled, and Lydia frowned, eager to preserve the sanctity of this moment. Was he flirting? Whenever a man's behavior was inscrutable, the answer was typically yes. She placed the book on the counter and her palm flat against its cover. He read the caution in her gesture and endeavored to correct himself. I only meant because sometimes the experience of reading can be corrupted by too many opinions. He looked at the book beneath her hand. A remarkable book. Remarkable. She conceded a smile, lifting her scanner from its cradle and pointing it toward the book. When he returned the following Monday, he went directly to the counter, even though Lydia was busy with another customer. He waited to one side, hands clasped in front of him, and when the customer left, they smiled broadly at each other. Well, she said, even more incredible the second time. Yes, Lydia clapped her hands. One of the book's main characters had a condition where she couldn't prevent herself from jumping off high things. She didn't want to die, but she was constantly hurting herself because of this dangerous impulse. I have the same condition, Javier confessed suddenly. What? No. The condition was fictional. And yet, Lydia had it too. Anytime she stood too close to the balcony railing at home, she had to dig her fingers in. She had to press her heels to the floor. She was afraid that one day she would leap over without thinking, without purpose. She would splatter on the pavement below, and the Acapulco traffic would screech and blare, swerving needlessly around her. The ambulance would be too late. Luca would be orphaned, and everyone would misinterpret the act as suicide. Lydia had run the scenario through her brain 1,000 times as an attempted antidote. I must not jump. I thought I was the only one in the world, Javier confessed. I thought it was a crazy fabrication of my mind. And then there it was, in the book. Lydia didn't realize her mouth was hanging open until she closed it. She sat back onto her stool with a bump. But I thought I was the only one, she said. Javier straightened his body away from the counter. You also? Lydia nodded. Well, my God, he said in English, and then he laughed. We will start a support group. And then he stood there, talking with her for so long that she eventually offered him a cup of coffee, which he accepted. She pulled a stool around to the far side of the counter so he could drink it in comfort. He was careful not to get foam on his mustache. They talked about literature and poetry and economics and politics and the music they both adored. And he stayed for nearly 2 hours until she began to worry that he'd be missed somewhere. But he waved his hand dismissively. There is nothing out there more important than this. It was just as Lydia had always hoped life in her bookstore would be one day. In between the workday drudgery of running a business, that she might entertain customers who were as lively and engaging as the books around them. If I had 3 more customers like you, I'd be set for life, she said, taking her last sip of coffee. He placed a hand across his chest and bowed slightly. I shall try to be enough. And then he said casually, softly, if I had met you in a different life, I would ask you to marry me. Lydia stood abruptly from her stool and shook her head. I'm sorry, Javier said. I didn't mean to make you uncomfortable. She gathered the cups in silence. The treachery wasn't in receiving his confession. The treachery was in her unspoken response. In a different life, she might have said yes. I should get back to work, she said instead. I have to place an order this afternoon. I have to prepare some parcels for the mail. He took 7 new books with him that day, 3 of which were Lydia's recommendations. On the following Friday morning, a summer shower washed down the street, and 2 large, worrisome men crowded themselves in beneath the awning that hung above Lydia's bookshop door. Moments later, Javier appeared, and Lydia felt a strong measure of happiness. There would be new books to discuss. She tried to behave naturally, but as she watched those men in the doorway, her breath constricted in her chest. They make you nervous? Javier observed. I just don't know what they want. Lydia paced from her usual position, emerging from behind the register. She, like all the other shop owners on this street, already paid the monthly mordidas imposed by the cartel. She couldn't afford to pay more. I will send them off, Javier said. Lydia protested, grabbing his arm, growing louder even as Javier's voice dropped to a comforting hush. He stepped around her when she tried to block his path. They will hurt you, she whispered as severely as she could without raising alarm. He smiled at her in a way that made his mustache twitch and assured her, they will not. Lydia ducked behind the counter, lowering her head as Javier opened the door and stepped outside. She watched in astonishment as he spoke to the 2 bulky thugs beneath her awning. Both men gestured to the rain, but Javier pointed a finger, made a shooing gesture with his hand, and the men trotted off into the downpour. Lydia was reluctant to understand. Even as his visits continued and lengthened, as their conversations deepened into more personal matters, as she caught fleeting glimpses of the men on 2 other occasions, Lydia willfully forgot the power Javier had wielded on that rainy morning. When eventually he spoke adoringly about his wife, whom he called La Reina de mi Corazón, the Queen of my Heart, Lydia felt her defenses relax. Those shields dropped further still when he revealed the existence of a young mistress whom he called La Reina de mis Pantalones, the Queen of my Pants. Disgusting, she said, but she surprised herself by laughing too. It was hardly unusual for a man to have an affair, but talking so openly about it with another woman was something else. For that reason, the confession served both to cure Lydia of any flattered wisp of attachment and, as Javier revealed more and more of his secret self, to turn the key in the intimate lock of their friendship. They became confidants, sharing jokes and observations and disappointments. They even spoke at times about the irritating things their spouses did. If you were married to me, I would never behave that way, Javier said when she complained about Sebastián leaving his dirty socks on the kitchen counter. Of course not, she laughed. You'd be an ideal husband. I'd wash every sock in the house. Sure. I'd burn all the socks and buy new ones each week. Mm-hmm. I'd forgo socks altogether, if it would make you happy. Lydia laughed in spite of herself. She'd learned to roll her eyes at these proclamations because, in the weather of their friendship, his flirtation was only a passing cloud. There were far more important storms between them. They discovered, for example, that both of their fathers had died young from cancer, a fact that would have bonded them all by itself. They'd both had good dads and then lost them. It's like being a member of the shittiest club in the world, Javier said to her. For Lydia, it had been nearly 15 years, and though her sorrow was now irregular, when she did stumble into it, Her grief was still as acute as the day her father had died. I know, Javier said, even though she didn't say these things out loud. So she endured his intense flattery, and he in turn accepted, perhaps even relished, her wholesale rejection of his flirtation. She came to think of it as part of his charm. But Lydia, he told her reverently, placing both hands on his heart, my other loves notwithstanding, you truly are la reina de mi alma, the queen of my soul. And what would your poor wife say about that? She countered. My magnificent wife only wants me to be happy. She's a saint. He spoke frequently of his only child, a 16-year-old daughter who was at boarding school in Barcelona. Everything about him changed when he talked about her. His voice, his face, his manner. His love for her was so earnest that he handled even the subject of her with tremendous care. Her name was like a fine glass bauble he was afraid of dropping. I joke about my many loves, but in truth, there is only one, he smiled at Lydia. Marta es mi cielo, mi luna, y todas mis estrellas. I am a mother, Lydia nodded. I know this love. He sat across from her on the stool she'd come to think of as his. That love is so vast, I sometimes fear it, he said. I can never hope to earn it, so I fear it will disappear. It will consume me. And at the same time, it's the only good thing I've ever done in my life. Oh, Javier, that can't be true, Lydia said. The subject made him morose. He shook his head, rubbed his eyes roughly beneath the glasses. It's just that my life hasn't turned out as I intended, he said. You know how it is. But she didn't. After weeks of learning about each other, this was where their common language faltered. With the exception of having only one child, Lydia's life had turned out precisely as she'd always wished it might. She'd given up hoping for the daughter she could no longer have. She'd accepted that absence because she'd worked at it. She was content with her choices, more than content. Lydia was happy. But Javier looked at her through the warp of his lenses, and she could see the yearning on his face to be understood. She pressed her lips together. Tell me, she said. He removed the glasses and folded the stems. He placed them in his breast pocket and blinked, his eyes small and raw without their accustomed shield. I thought I would be a poet, he laughed. Ridiculous, right? In this day and age? She put her hand on top of his. I thought I would be a scholar, a quiet life. I'd do quite well with poverty, I think. She twisted her mouth, touching the elegant watch on his wrist. I'm dubious, he shrugged. I guess I do like shoes. And steak, she reminded him. He laughed. Yes, steak. Who doesn't like steak? Your book habit alone would bankrupt most people. Dios mío, you're right, Lydia. I'd be a terrible pauper. The worst. She agreed. After a beat, she said, It's never too late, Javier. If you're truly unhappy, you're still a young man. I'm 51. Younger than she thought, even. Practically a baby. And what have you got to be so unhappy about anyway? He looked down at the counter, and Lydia was surprised to see genuine torment cross his features. She lowered her voice and leaned in. Then you could choose a different path, Javier. You can. You're such a gifted person, such a capable person. What's stopping you? Ah, he shook his head, replacing his glasses. She watched him pushing his face back into its customary shapes. It's all a romantic dream now. It's over. I made my choices long ago, and this is where they've led me. She squeezed his hand. It's not so bad, right? It was something she'd say to Luca, to shepherd him toward optimism. Javier blinked slowly, tipped his head to one side, an ambiguous gesture. It will have to do. She straightened up behind the counter and took a sip of her lukewarm coffee. Your choices yielded Marta. His eyes shined. Yes, Marta, he said. And you. The next time he came, he brought a box of conchas and sat in his usual place. There were several customers in the shop, so he opened the box and placed two of the sweet treats on napkins while Lydia walked the aisles helping people with their requests. When they approached the counter to pay for their goods, Javier greeted them as if he worked there. He offered them conchas. When at last Lydia and Javier were alone, he withdrew a small moleskin notebook from the interior pocket of his jacket and set it on the counter as well. What's this? Lydia asked. Javier swallowed nervously. My poetry. Lydia's eyes grew wide with delight. I've never shared it with anyone except Marta, he said. She's studying poetry in school, and French, and mathematics. She's much more gifted than her old papa. Oh, Javier. He touched the corner of the book nervously. I've been writing poetry all my life, since I was a child. I thought you might like to hear one. Lydia pulled her stool closer to the counter and leaned toward him, her chin resting on her propped and folded hands. Between them, the conchas stained their napkins with grease. Javier opened the book, its pages soft from wear. He leafed carefully through them until he came to the page he had in mind. He cleared his throat before he began. Oh, the poem was terrible. It was both grave and frivolous, so bad that it made Lydia love him much, much more, because of how vulnerable he was in sharing it with her. When he finished reading and looked up for her reaction, his face was a twist of worry. But her eyes were bright and reassuring, and she genuinely meant the words she gave him in that moment. How beautiful! How very beautiful! The maturing friendship with Javier was surprising in its swiftness and intensity. The flirtation had mostly ceased, and in its place, she discovered an intimacy she'd seldom experienced outside of family. There was no feeling of romance on Lydia's end, but their bond was refreshing. Javier reminded her, in the middle of her mothering years, that life was exciting, that there was always the possibility of something or someone previously undiscovered. On her birthday, a day Lydia did not recall revealing to him, Javier arrived with a silver parcel the size of a book. The ribbon said, Jacques Genin. The principal chocolatier in Paris, Javier explained. Lydia demurred, but not convincingly. She loved chocolate, and she accidentally ate every last one of the tiny masterpieces before Sebastian and Luca arrived at her shop that evening to take her out for her birthday dinner. Because of an eruption of violence between rival cartels in Acapulco, Lydia and her family, indeed most families in the city, no longer frequented their favorite neighborhood cafes. The challenger to the establishment was a new cartel that called itself Los Jardineros, a name that failed, initially, to evoke the appropriate fear in the populace. That problem had been transitory. Shortly after their formation, everyone in the city knew that the gardeners used guns only when they didn't have time to indulge their creativity. Their preferred tools were more intimate: spade, axe, sickle, hook, machete. The simple instruments of hacking and trenching. With these, los jardineros moved the earth. With these, they unseated and buried their rivals. A few of the dethroned survivors managed to join the ranks of their conquerors. Most fled the city. The result was a recent decrease in bloodshed as the emergent winner flung a shroud of uneasy calm across the shoulders of Acapulco. Nearly 4 months of relative quiet followed, and the citizens of Acapulco cautiously returned to the streets, to the restaurants and shops. They were eager to repair the damage to their economy. They were ready for a cocktail. So, in the safest district, where tourist money had always encouraged some restraint, in a restaurant selected more for its security than for its menu, and surrounded by the shining faces of her family, Lydia blew out the candle on her 32nd birthday cake. Later that night, after Luca went to bed and Sebastian opened a bottle of wine on the couch, their conversation turned inevitably to the condition of life in Acapulco. Lydia stood at the open counter, leaning across it with a glass of wine at her elbow. "It was nice to be able to go out to dinner tonight," she said. "It felt almost normal, right?" Sebastian was in the living room, his legs propped on the coffee table, crossed at the ankles. "There were a lot of people out." It was the first time they'd taken Luca out for a meal since last summer. "Next, we have to get the tourists back," Sebastian said. Lydia took a deep breath. Tourism had always been the lifeblood of Acapulco, and the violence had scared most of those tourists away. She didn't know how long she'd be able to keep the shop afloat if they didn't return. It was tempting to hope the recent peace signaled a sea change. "Do you think things might really get better now?" She asked because Sebastian's knowledge of the cartels was exhaustive, which both impressed and discomfited her. He knew things. Most people were like Lydia. They didn't want to know. They tried to insulate themselves from the ugliness of the narco violence because they couldn't handle it. But Sebastian was ravenous for it. "A free press was the last line of defense," he said. "The only thing left standing between the people of Mexico and complete annihilation." It was his vocation, and when they were young, she'd admired that idealism. She'd imagined that any child of Sebastian's would come out of her womb honorably, with a fully formed, unimpeachable morality. She wouldn't even have to teach their babies right from wrong. But now the cartels murdered a Mexican journalist every few weeks, and Lydia recoiled from her husband's integrity. It felt sanctimonious, selfish. She wanted Sebastian alive more than she wanted his strong principles. She wished he would quit, do something simpler, safer. She tried to be supportive, but sometimes it made her so angry that he chose this danger. When that anger flared up and intruded, they moved around it like a piece of furniture too big for the room it occupied. "It's already better," Sebastian said thoughtfully from behind his wine glass. "I mean, it's quieter," Lydia said. "But is it really better?" "That depends on your criteria, I guess." He looked up at her. "If you like to go out to dinner, then yes. Things are better." Lydia frowned. She really did like to go out to dinner. Was she that superficial? "The new jefe is smart," Sebastian said. "He knows stability is the key and he wants peace. So we'll see. Maybe things will get better under Los Jardineros than they were before." "Better how? You think he can fix the economy? Bring back tourism?" "I don't know, maybe," Sebastian shrugged. "If he can really staunch the violence long term. For now, at least it's limited to other narcos. They're not running around murdering innocents for fun." "What about that kid on the beach last week?" "Collateral damage." Lydia cringed and took a gulp of wine. Her husband wasn't a callous man. She hated when he talked like this. Sebastian saw her flinch and stood up to reach across the counter. He squeezed her hands. "I know it's awful," he said. "But that kid on the beach was an accident. He was caught in the crossfire, that's all I meant. They weren't gunning for him." He tugged lightly on her hand. "Come, sit with me." Lydia rounded the counter and joined him on the couch. "I know you don't like to think of it like this, but at the end of the day, these guys are businessmen, and this one is smarter than most." He put his arm around her. "He's not your typical narco. In a different life, he could have been Bill Gates or something, an entrepreneur." "Great," she said, threading one arm across his midsection and resting her head on his chest. "Maybe he should run for mayor." "I think he's more of a Chamber of Commerce kind of guy." Sebastian laughed, but Lydia couldn't. They were quiet for a moment, and then Sebastian said, "La lechuza." "What?" "That's his name. The owl." Now she was able to laugh. "Are you serious?" She sat up to look him in the face to determine if he was messing with her. Sometimes he fed her nonsense just to test how gullible she was. This time, his face was innocent. "The owl? That's a terrible name," she laughed again. "Owls aren't scary." "What do you mean? Owls are terrifying," Sebastian said. She shook her head. "Whew," he said. "Oh my God, stop it." He worked his fingers into her hair, and she felt content there, leaning against his chest. She could smell the sweet red wine on his breath. "I love you, Sebastian." "Whew," he said again. They both laughed. They kissed. They left their wine on the table. It wasn't until much later that night, when Lydia sat trying to read in the circle of lamplight that illuminated only her side of the bed, when Sebastian had long since fallen asleep, his head resting on the bare skin of his arm, his snore a soft veil of familiarity in the room, that Lydia felt a dart of something worrisome pierce her consciousness. Something Sebastian had said. In a different life, he could have been Bill Gates. She folded her book closed and set it on her nightstand. In a different life, the words echoed uncomfortably through her mind. She pulled off the covers and swung her legs over the edge of the bed. Sebastian stirred but didn't wake. Her baggy t-shirt barely covered her backside, and her feet were cold against the moonlit tiles of the hallway. She padded toward the kitchen, to the table where the three of them often ate dinner together. His backpack was there, not entirely zipped shut. She pulled out his laptop and turned on the light over the stove. There were notebooks in the backpack, too, and several file folders stuffed with photos and documents. Lydia hoped she was wrong, but she knew, somehow, what she would find before she found it. Near the bottom of a stack of pictures in the second folder. There, sitting at a table on a veranda with several other men, the face that was now dear to her. The wide mustache, the recognizable glasses. There was no question who La Lechuza was. Behind the wine and the cake and the dinner, she could still taste his chocolates on her tongue. Chapter 5. At home, Luca's little room has a nightlight in the shape of Noah's Ark. It's not a very bright one, but it makes enough light that when he has a nightmare and shoves back the covers to run into Papi, he's able to see where his bare feet meet the tiled floor. So he's disoriented when he wakes up in the darkened room at the Hotel Duquesa Imperial. He can't make out a single shape in the blackness. He sits up in the unfamiliar bed, thrusting his legs over the edge. "Papi!" It's always Papi he calls for first. Bappi, whose side of the bed he approaches. Bappi, he taps on the shoulder, who tucks him into the fold of his arm, who doesn't make him go back to his own room. Bappi's pillow smells faintly of the amber liquid he drinks at bedtime. Mummy is great for the daytime things, but Bappi is better, infinitely better, at tolerating disruptions to his sleep. Bappi, Luca calls a second time, and his voice sounds strange without the closed walls to contain it. Luca clutches the edge of the puffy blanket. Mummy, he tries then. There's breathing nearby, which ceases, then rearranges itself.
I'm here, mi amor. Come here.
Mami. Luca draws his legs back beneath the covers and leans against the wall of pillows behind him. And that's when it returns, all at once. The memory of what happened. The truth of where they are. The breath squeezes out of Luca's small body, and his knees curl up to his face. He covers his head with his arms and screams without intending to. The sound escapes from him. Mami sits up quickly on her knees and reaches for the lamp, groping for the switch. Now the room is illuminated, but Luca can sense that only through the clamped shutters of his eyelids. Mami pulls him close and folds him up, gets her legs beneath him so the knot of him is on her lap, and they stay like that for a long time. She doesn't try to stop him from screaming or crying. She just hangs on and wraps herself around him as best she can. It's as if they are riding out a hurricane. When the worst of it has passed, perhaps 15 minutes later, Luca's eyes feel like sandpaper, and he still can't find a way to loosen the joints of his body. But at least he's breathing again. In and out. In and out. His face is swollen. Lydia gets out of bed, wearing one of the long t-shirts she bought at Walmart, and Luca writhes. There's a physical pain to their minor separation. She grabs a bottle of water from the dresser and then darts back to him.
I'm right here, she says. I'm not going anywhere.
Luca lies on his side, curled up. She twists the cap off the bottle and takes a drink, then hands it to him. Her black hair is a wild tumble. He shakes his head, but she insists. Sit up. Drink. He drags his body upright, and she holds the bottle to his lips, tips it in for him like she did when he was a baby. Someone once told me that the only good advice for grief is to stay hydrated, because everything else is just chingaderas. Mami cursed again. That's the second time since yesterday. Luca closes his lips, forcing the bottle out, but she hands it to him. Have some more, she says. Her face is splotchy but dry, and there are dark circles beneath her eyes. Her expression is one Luca has never seen before, and he fears it might be permanent. It's as if seven fishermen have cast their hooks into her from different directions, and they're all pulling at once. One from the eyebrow, one from the lip, another at the nose, one from the cheek. Mami is contorted. She turns the alarm clock face so she can see it. When she leans over the nightstand, the weight of Papi's wedding ring drags at the gold chain she wears around her neck, dwarfing the three little loops that have always lived there. She tucks it back inside the collar of her t-shirt. 4:48, she says. No more sleep for us, right? Luca doesn't answer. He drinks from the water bottle. She gathers her tumultuous hair into a ponytail, stands up from the bed again, and turns on the television. She finds an English language cartoon. Here, she says. Practice. Even though he doesn't need practice, his English is excellent. She orders room service, eggs and toast and fruit. The thought of eating makes Luca's stomach churn, so he stops thinking about it. He lets his eyes hook into the television and his body soften. His head feels like a cinder block, his nose stuffed. He opens his mouth to breathe gently. But when Mommy steps into the bathroom and turns the shower on, Luca gets up from the bed and pads across the room to join her. She's sitting on the toilet, so he perches on the edge of the tub until she's finished. Then he takes a turn. Not because he has to go, but because he doesn't want to be alone in the other room. He sits there with his underwear around his ankles until he hears the handle squeak and the water stop. He stands and flushes just as she pulls back the curtain. "You should take a shower too," she says, stepping out, wrapping herself in a towel. "It might be a few days before you have another chance." Luca looks at her in the mirror and shakes his head once. It's impossible for him to shower. To be alone there, wedged between the tiled walls with the sound of gunfire raking across Abuela's back patio. He shakes his head again and shuts his eyes tightly, but it's no use. He's reliving it again, his body frantic, his breath a whip of panic. The sound that comes out of him this time is something between a whimper and a screech. He tries to be louder than the gunfire in his head. "It's okay, it's okay, it's okay," Mommy says, holding him, and even though Luca knows these words are not strictly true, he clings to them regardless. She washes him instead in the sink with sudsy water and a washcloth, like she used to do when he was a baby. Neck, ears, armpits, tummy, back, bottom, undercarriage, legs, and feet. She swabs off the grime, the spots of dried blood, the clinging flecks of vomit. She makes him clean and dry. She pats him down with a white towel, fluffy and warm against his skin. Even though they're expecting the room service delivery, the knock at the door, when it comes, startles them both. They are jittery from grief, and there's a thinness in the air that amplifies every sound. He doesn't want to, but Luca waits in the bathroom with the door locked while his mother answers the delivery. He hums softly to himself as soon as he's alone, but it's not music. There's no melody in it. Lydia hesitates between the two locked doors. Behind the bathroom one, she can hear the tuneless humming. Behind the other, a man's voice repeats the announcement of their breakfast delivery. She is barefoot on the carpet, and her hands shake as she lugs the desk chair out of the way and reaches for the doorknob. She wants to stretch up on her bare toes and look out the peephole to make sure. But how can she? How can she when all she can imagine is seeing the dark tunnel of a gun barrel on the other side and then immediately seeing nothing at all ever again? But if that's the fate that awaits her, she tells herself, then no. At least she won't unlock the door and invite it in. She holds her breath as she reaches out silently and plants her hands on either side of the peephole. The young man outside pushes a cart laden with silver trays. He wears a uniform. His face is scarred with acne. His name tag says, Ical. None of it means anything about their safety. She returns to the flats of her feet, pads over to the dresser, and removes her machete from the top drawer. "Be right there, just a second," she says. She's wearing the thick bathrobe she found in the closet, and she slips the machete into its baggy pocket. She keeps her hand in there and grips the handle tightly. She says the word okay out loud to herself, and then she opens the door. Ical, it is immediately obvious, is not a sicario. He's barely even a room service delivery boy. He ducks his head and clears his throat and seems embarrassed to be in a hotel room with a woman wearing a bathrobe. He averts his eyes as he steps past her and places her tray almost apologetically on the desk. Then he returns to his waiting cart in the doorway and hands her the billfold for her signature. Lydia feels confident enough to leave the machete in her pocket momentarily while she signs it. She thanks him and hands it back. And then, just as the door is about to swing closed, he says, "Wait, I almost forgot." And Lydia's hand darts back into her pocket. But he only hands her some cutlery wrapped in two cloth napkins. "And this," he says, producing a padded envelope from a lower shelf. "The front desk asked me to bring it up." Lydia takes a small step back. "What is it?" "A delivery," he says. "A ride for you last night." Lydia shakes her head. "No one knows we're here. No one knows we're here." A panic refrain. He's holding the parcel out between them, but Lydia makes no move to reach for it. She stares at the brown paper. She can't see any markings on it, not even her name. "Shall I put it on the desk with the food?" he asks. He gestures inside, but seems reluctant to step back into the room without an invitation. "No," Lydia says. She knows she's acting crazy. She doesn't care. "I don't want it."
"Señora?"
She shakes her head again. "I don't want it," she repeats. "Just get rid of it." Igal attempts to suppress the confusion from his face with a firm nod. He replaces the parcel on his cart, and it's not until its muffled rattle has almost reached the elevators at the end of the corridor that Lydia changes her mind. She opens the door and chases after him.
"Wait!"
When she returns to the room, Luca has already emerged from the bathroom and is standing over the tray of food, removing the covers from the plates. Lydia holds the small parcel away from her body as she carries it into the bathroom and places it carefully on a towel in the bottom of the tub. She steps out and shuts the door, closing the parcel inside. She fixes her coffee from the tray, drinks it in one long guzzle, and then dresses quickly, hitching her scratchy new jeans up beneath the hotel robe. Luca eats standing up, wearing only his underwear. He is starving, and that hunger feels like a betrayal. How can his body want food? He jams a slice of toast into his mouth. How can the butter taste so good? Luca chews it into a paste before swallowing. He watches his mother sideways without turning his head away from the television. He sees the way Mommy screws her lips up to one side, and he decides he's going to take care of her. He won't be a baby anymore. He decides this very matter-of-factly, in a single instant, and he knows it to be immediately true. "We should go to El Norte," he says, because he suspects that's her plan anyway, and he wants to confirm that it's a good one, the only one, to get to a planet where no one can reach them. "Yes," Mommy stands beside the bed in her jeans and robe. She seems to have lost track of what she was doing halfway through getting dressed. She seems both hurried and unable to move. "We'll go to Denver," she says after a moment. She has an uncle there. Lydia slips a plain white t-shirt over her head and steps out from inside the puddle of robe around her feet. She feels so prickly and raw that even the cotton of the t-shirt brushing against her skin sends goosebumps racing down her arms. She rubs them off and tells Luca to hurry up and get dressed when he's finished eating. Back in the bathroom, she stares down at the padded brown envelope in the bottom of the tub and can't decide whether she made the right decision by bringing it into the room. Maybe it doesn't matter. Someone knows they're here. So now they have to leave immediately, regardless of what's inside. It wasn't curiosity that made her run after the food delivery kid. She's not curious. She doesn't want to know what's inside. But she knows that disinterest is a luxury she can no longer afford to indulge. If she hopes to survive this ordeal with Luca, then she needs to pay attention to every single detail. She needs to be alert to every scrap of available information. She lifts the envelope carefully by one corner and examines the back seal. There's nothing out of the ordinary. She's going to have to open it. In here? In the bathroom? Or should she take it out on the balcony in case it explodes?
Carajo,
she says out loud. You talking to me, mami? Luca says through the door.
No, mijo. Get dressed.
She puts the parcel to her ear, but can hear nothing inside. No ticking, no beeping. She lifts the parcel to her nose and smells it, but there's no discernible odor. She carefully slides one finger beneath the sealed edge, closes her eyes, and gently pulls her finger along the loosening flap. In her head, the pounding of her own fear is louder than the ripping paper, but now here it is, opened in her hands. An ordinary brown envelope. No dreadful toxic powder spills out. No poisonous cloud of doom ascends. Inside, tied with a pale blue ribbon, is an English language copy of Love in the Time of Cholera, a book she once discussed with Javier, one of their many shared favorites. There's something tucked between its pages. She tugs on the ribbon, which gives way and falls to the floor at her bare feet. Her body feels like an arrow that's been launched from its bow, but hasn't yet found its target. She's suspended, arcing, accountable to the laws of gravity. She opens to the page where an unsealed envelope is wedged into the spine. Of course she knows. She knew from the very first sound of mayhem in the yard that Javier is responsible for the massacre of her family. It feels as impossible as it is true. But until this moment, she's protected herself from fully acknowledging that fact. Because once she accepts that incontrovertible truth, she must also acknowledge her own guilt. She knew this man. She knew him. And yet she failed to appreciate the danger he presented. She'd failed to protect her family. Lydia can't think about any of this yet. She isn't ready. She must find a way to delay her despair. Luca is the only thing that matters now. Luca. He is still in danger. Get dressed, she calls again, her voice pitching out at an unfamiliar angle. She looks down at the book in her hand. A passage is highlighted there, the moment when the widowed heroine, Fermina Daza, reeling in the aftermath of her husband's death, encounters the man, Florentino Ariza, whom she rejected 50 years earlier. Femina, he said, I have waited for this opportunity for more than half a century to repeat to you once again my vow of eternal fidelity and everlasting love. Lydia thrusts the book away from her, and it somersaults into the tub. The envelope remains in her hand. She considers dropping it too and leaving it there, but she needs to know what it says. Her stomach plunges. She pulls the card out of its thick envelope and sees white lilies on the front. Mi más sentido pésame. Inside, the handwriting is immediately familiar. Lydia, hay sangre en tus manos también. Lo siento por tu dolor y el mío. Ahora estamos destinados a permanecer eternamente unidos por este pesar. Jamás imaginé este capítulo para nosotros. Pero no te preocupes, mi reina del alma. Tu sufrimiento será breve. Javier. There is blood on your hands as well. I'm sorry for your pain and mine. Now we are bound forever in this grave. I never imagined this chapter for us. But do not worry, queen of my soul. Your suffering will be brief. She drops the card, and it lands in the toilet, where it darkens at once. Lydia's not sure what she'd been expecting when she opened it. There's nothing he could have written there that would make any difference. No quiet slashing of ink on paper can resuscitate her dead mother, her husband. No apology or explanation can reanimate Yennefer's brain, pin her soul back into her body. That girl smelled like grapefruit and sugar, and now she's gone. Lydia beats back a sob, using an English word she's never liked. Fuck. It works, so she says it again and again. Perhaps she'd hoped the card might illuminate something. She reads it once more, floating, the ink beginning to bleed, and she's haunted by the familiarity of the handwriting. What had she missed? How can this be real? She tries, but she can't force it to make sense, and the effort makes her dizzy. Only one thing is clear. Javier knows where they are. She doesn't have time to panic or reflect. She has to get Luca out of there. Now. They have to run. She bangs open the bathroom door and hisses at Luca once more to get dressed. He doesn't answer, and when she looks up, she sees that he's already dressed in fresh jeans and his father's red hat, that he's sitting on the chair beside the desk, wriggling his feet into his new socks. Oh, andale, she says. Good. But then he reaches out for the tray of food to cram in a bite before tackling the other sock, and Lydia lunges toward him. She smacks a toast from his hand, and it skids to the floor. Mommy! Luca is shocked. She only shakes her head. Don't eat it. Don't eat any more food. Luca is silent. I don't know if it's safe. She thinks about dragging him into the bathroom and sticking a finger down his throat, but there's no time. She crams all their belongings into her mother's overnight bag and the two backpacks. She hasn't even put on her bra yet. No time. Her hair is wet. It's leaving a damp ring around the shoulders of her t-shirt. She jams her bare feet into her mother's quilted sneakers, straps the backpack on herself, and grabs her mother's bag. You ready? Luca nods and picks up the second backpack, the one they bought at Walmart. Super quiet, she says. No noise. Luca seals his mouth. Lydia pauses at the door to lean her ear against the wood and listen before she dares to open it. She pins Luca to the wall beside her and then cracks the door. The hallway is empty, the only sound coming from a television in the room across the hall. She takes Luca's hand and tugs him out, wedging a towel in the door so it won't even click as it closes. They run silently to the service stairs, and when Lydia hears the ding of the elevator at the other end of the hall, she shoves Luca through the door. 7 flights down, Luca flies in front of her. Lydia's feet touch every 3rd or 4th step along the way. Chapter 6. They emerge from the stairwell into a small parking lot behind the kitchen and the stink of hot dumpster garbage. Lydia tells Luca they're going to be fine, but they must be both calm and quick now. They have to keep their heads. There's a wall of hedges to hide the work of tourism from the tourists, and together, they shove through it, out onto a manicured path that winds among the sparkling pools before reaching the beach. Lydia listens all the time for the sounds of pursuit behind them, but so far, there's nothing but the hushy voice of the ocean greeting the shore. The towel hut isn't open yet, but a man on the pool deck is pushing a cart of clean, folded towels, and he offers one to Lydia, who smiles and slings it around her neck. Thank you, she says, and takes one for Luca, too. On the sand, they take off their shoes and try to make their silhouettes appear like casual morning beachcombers. In minutes, they arrive safely at the adjacent hotel property. They put their shoes back on and walk briskly through the lobby from back to front, discarding the towels on a lounger as they go. They pass potted palms and waiters carrying trays of orange juice and the aroma of fresh coffee. And Lydia takes 2 muffins from an unattended tray of food on a stand. When they arrive at the hotel's front door, there's a shuttle bus waiting. They get on. Soon, they're driving past the entry of the Hotel Duquesa Imperial, and Lydia can see three black SUVs lurking in the parking lot. She clutches at Sebastian's wedding band hanging from the gold chain around her neck and feels for the three interlocking loops. She doesn't know how Javier found them, or why. Did he mean only to scare the shit out of her? To spike her grief with terror? Or to warn her? To soil the purity of her anguish with his weird, revolting compassion? His motives are messy. Lydia cannot begin to understand them. That highlighted passage he chose, the dead husband, the vulgar proclamation of love. Does Javier not remember what happens next? That Fermina Daza is repulsed by the declaration, that she curses his name and throws him out onto the street, that she wishes him dead and orders him never to return. Lydia understands nothing. For an instant, only an instant, she considers telling the driver to stop. She imagines walking over to those SUVs and knocking on one of the driver's windows. She thinks of going to Javier, wherever he is, meeting him outside the confines of the bookstore for the first time. She might embrace him, throw herself on his mercy, demand an explanation. She might beg him just to get it over with. She might punch and kick him, pull the machete from her pant leg, slash his face, slash his throat. And then she looks over at Luca, and it all evaporates. She's in a stuffy shuttle bus, and there's something sticky on the seat. The ghost of some child's melted candy. She is here with Luca, and she will protect him at all costs. This is the only thing left that matters. Ahead of them, a black SUV rolls slowly across the intersection. "Can you take us to the bus depot?" Lydia asks the driver.
"I'm not supposed to deviate from my route."
"But there are no other passengers. It's only a few extra blocks. Who's going to know?"
"GPS." The driver points to a screen strapped onto his dash. "There's a different shuttle that goes to the bus terminal. This one's for the shopping district. You want to go back to the hotel? You can take the other shuttle."
"Please," Lydia says. "I can pay you."
In response, the driver brakes and opens the door. Lydia shoots him a hateful look, but gathers her things and prompts Luca off the bus in front of her. It's too early for shopping, and the streets of the district are deserted. The driver closes the door behind them and rolls away. The boulevard is wide and open. It's only half a mile's walk from here to the bus station, but it feels an impossible, exposed distance to cover, like walking across a battlefield without armor or weaponry. She hides her fear well, but Luca can sense it anyway, in the cold slick of his mother's hand. Getting to the bus depot feels like some deranged version of the game Crossy Road, where instead of dodging taxis and trucks and trains, Luca and Mami have to duck and lurch between the possibility of concealed narcos in their tinted SUVs. The ever-present threat of gunfire screams through Luca's mind like the unexpected train.
"Don't worry," he tells Mami. "If anyone was looking for us, they'd go to the central terminal downtown, right? They wouldn't expect us to be all the way out here in the Amante."
Luca doesn't know about the parcel, but his logic is enough to make Lydia smile for a moment.
"That's what I thought too. Smart kid."
She tugs the brim of Papi's red baseball cap lower on Luca's face. He walks too fast.
"We have to walk like normal," she says. "Slow down."
"Normal people are sometimes late for a bus." Luca's limbs feel twitchy.
"There's always another bus," she says.
It's 7 minutes past six in the morning when Mami purchases their one-way tickets to Mexico City, so they have 13 minutes to kill before the bus leaves. The terminal is a modern structure, mostly glass, and even though the sun isn't up yet, the sky has begun to lighten and Luca can make out the shapes of the cars in the parking lot. There's only one SUV, and it appears to be empty, lights off.
but someone could be inside waiting, seat reclined, asleep on the job. Luca studies the SUV while Mommy collects her change from the lady behind the counter. It's Sunday, so the buses back to Mexico City will be crowded with families heading home from their mini vacations. Luca and Mommy can look like one of those families. There's a handful of energetic children in the terminal already, chattering and skipping circles around their bleary-eyed, coffee-sipping parents. Mommy herds Luca into the handicapped stall in the ladies' bathroom and makes him stand on the toilet seat inside. It's the sort of thing she usually wouldn't tolerate. Luca doesn't think anyone in the terminal noticed them, and he feels pretty sure because he was studying the faces. But if there is someone looking for them here, if they do track them first to the bus terminal, then to the women's bathroom, and finally to the handicapped stall, well, then standing on a toilet with your back against a wall doesn't seem like a very effective way to survive. Luca leans his hands down on his knees and tries not to shake. He watches Mommy remove her backpack and prop it in the corner before hanging the overnight bag from the hook on the back of the door. She has to dig nearly to the bottom of it to find a pair of socks. They're still attached by a plastic barb, which Mommy snaps before putting them on. He doesn't know how she does that. Luca always has to cut them with scissors. Mommy doesn't look that strong, but he knows she's really powerful because she can always snap the plastic barb like it's nothing. She digs out a bra, too, and wriggles into it beneath her shirt. Then she sips up Abuela's gold sneakers and turns her back to Luca so her feet are pointing in the right direction in case anyone looks under the stall. They're alone in the bathroom, but he speaks to her very quietly anyway, so they can hear if the door opens, if anyone comes in. "So we're going to Colorado?" Lydia nods, and Luca wraps his arms around her neck. He leans his chin on her shoulder. "Good plan." "No one would ever think of Colorado." Lydia stares at the bag hanging in front of them and tries to remember if she ever mentioned Denver to Javier. Why would she have? She's never been there and hasn't seen her uncle since she was a kid.
"Plus it's far," Luca says.
"Yes," Mommy says. "Very far away from here." In fact, Luca knows with some degree of precision just how far Denver is from Acapulco, almost 2,000 miles by car. He knows this because Luca has perfect direction, the way some prodigies have perfect pitch. He was born with it, an intrinsic sense of his position on the globe, like a human GPS, pinging his way through the universe. When he sees something on a map, it lodges in his memory forever.
"I'm going to miss the geography bee," he says.
He's been studying for months. In September, his school paid 600 pesos for him to take the international qualifying exam because his teacher was convinced he would bring home the $10,000 grand prize.
"I'm sorry, mijo," Lydia says, kissing his arm.
Luca shrugs.
"It doesn't matter."
Before yesterday, the geography bee had seemed so important to all of them. Now it feels like the most trivial thing in the world, along with everything else on the running to-do list Lydia kept beside the register in the bookshop. Fill out the church paperwork for Luca's communion, pay the water bill, take Abuela to her cardiology appointment, buy a gift for Jennifer's quinceañera. What a waste of time it had all been. Lydia feels annoyed that her niece won't get to see the music box she purchased for her special day. How expensive it was. She realizes, even as this thought occurs to her, how bizarre and awful it is, but she can't stop it from crashing in. She doesn't rebuke herself for thinking it. She does herself the small kindness of forgiving her malfunctioning logic. Luca whispers in her ear, "With a population of almost 700,000, Denver, nicknamed the Mile High City because of its elevation, is located just east of the Rocky Mountain foothills," reciting from memory of flashcards. It is the state capital of Colorado, and one quarter of its population claims Mexican heritage. Lydia squeezes his arm, reaches up, and runs a hand through his black hair. The summer before last, when Luca's enduring interest in maps began to shift from fascination to obsession, Lydia kept him busy at the bookstore with guidebooks and atlases. It seems impossible that back then, just so recently, Acapulco was bright with tourists and music and the shops and the sea. Rock pigeons strutted across the sand. Vast foreign cruise ships disgorged their sneakered passengers onto the streets, their pockets fat with dollars, their skin glistening from coconut-scented sunscreen. The dollars fill the bars and restaurants. In Lydia's bookshop, they fill the register. Those tourists bought the guidebooks and atlases along with serious novels and frivolous novels and souvenir keychains and tiny tubes of sand corked with tiny stoppers that Lydia kept in a big fishbowl beside the register. And ay, Dios mío, those tourists couldn't get enough of Luca. Lydia set him up like a puppet on a stool, and he'd tell them in precise English about the places where they came from. He was 6 years old. A wunderkind. With a population of 640,000, Portland is located at the confluence of the Columbia and Willamette Rivers and is the largest city in the state of Oregon. The city was incorporated in 1851, 65 years after its eastern namesake in coastal Maine. Henry, from Portland, Oregon, stood in front of Luca with his mouth hanging open. Marge, come here. You gotta see this. Do it again. Marge joined her husband, and Luca repeated his spiel. Incredible. Kid, you are just incredible. Marge, give the kid some money. Did you make all that up? Marge asked skeptically, digging in her purse for some money regardless. Nah, he knew the rivers, Henry defended him. How could he make that up? It's real, Luca said. I just remember things, especially about maps and places. Well, Henry's right. It's incredible. Marge gave him a dollar. And in perfect English. Where did you learn such perfect English? Acapulco, Luca said simply. And you too. Lydia watched in silence and felt obscenely proud. Smug, even. Her boy was perfect. So smart and accomplished. So guapo and happy. She'd been teaching him English for almost as long as he'd been speaking Spanish. It was a skill that she knew would serve him well, growing up in a tourist town. But he quickly outstripped her knowledge of the language, and then they proceeded to learn together, mostly on her phone or computer. YouTube lessons, Rosetta Stone, soap operas. They often spoke English to each other when Sebastián wasn't around, or when they pretended to have a secret in front of him. Sometimes they tried out slang on each other. She called Luca dude, and he called her shorty. Marge and Henry laughed at Luca's pragmatic charm and then gathered their friends from the cruise ship and returned to watch him perform. They offered him a dollar for every city he could tell them about. He made $37 that day and could have kept going, except the tourists had to get back to their ship. So yes, this geography bee has been almost 2 years coming. But Lydia cannot think of details right now, the annulled logistics of her life. Her brain can't hold them. Even the biggest, most fundamental facts seem impossible to comprehend. Outside the stall, the bathroom door swings open. There's no squeak, but they can tell someone has come in because suddenly the sounds beyond the door are temporarily louder and then softer again as the door swings shut. They both hold their breath. Luca is still draped over mommy's back, and she grips his arms where they encircle her neck. The pads of his fingers turn yellow as they dig into the bones of mommy's wrist. She doesn't move. He squeezes his eyes shut. But soon there's the sound of the door latching on the neighboring stall, an older woman loudly clearing her throat. Luca can feel Mommy let go of her breath, like the air leaving a deflated balloon. He puts his lips against her neck. After the lady in the stall next door finishes her business and washes her hands and compliments herself out loud in the bathroom mirror, it's time for them to venture back out. He knows they can't stay in this bathroom forever, but his heart beats in a clamorous thud when Mommy opens the door. It's time to get on the bus. When they cross the lobby, Luca registers the faces of the people who remain in the terminal. The immaculate lady behind the counter with her lips outlined a shade darker than the lips themselves. The man in his paper hat selling coffee. The couple with the fuzzy baby who are waiting until the last minute to board. On the television affixed to the wall, Luca sees a prim newscaster and then, starkly, Abuela's little house. The yellow crime scene tape flutters and sags. The camera focuses on the courtyard gate hanging open, and then the back patio, the tented shapes of Luca's family covered by plastic tarps, the grim faces of los policías as they walk, stoop, stand, scratch, breathe, as they do the things living people do when they walk among corpses. Luca squeezes his mother's hand, not to get her attention, but to prevent himself from crying out. She doesn't look up. She pulls him along the shiny tiled floor, but he feels as if he's walking in a sucking sand at high tide. Luca waits for the crack of a bullet to strike the front.